Ian, last time we met, and you won't remember, was here at the Brentwood Centre, around about 2000, end of the 90s, I think, and before in Hammersmith, 1974. Do you remember the Brentwood gig, and what a fantastic show it was?
Well, thanks very much. The shows that we've done over the years blur into memory in many cases. There are odd little highlights and actually some fairly tragic moments that do stay in the memory, but happily 99% of them are just in that big blur area. So I often think, well, if I can't remember it, then it's because nothing terrible happened.
No, nothing failed.
On the bright side, it must have been at least okay.
I tell you what I do like about you on stage is that you're not an artist who says, and this is a new track from our third album. You introduce each song, you make it a show.
Well, if it is, the third track from our new album, then I'm probably the best one to tell you. But it doesn't seem enough in itself, and to say nothing at all, sometimes is more elegant than just the platitudes and banalities that slip from the mouths of tight trousered long hair rock stars. you're standing there, something is expected of you. It's a bit like being best man at a wedding or something. You can be yourself and trip over your words and fall over and everybody loves you, or you can sit down to or stand up rather to deliver the perfect speech, carefully and meticulously notated, and everybody sits there looking a bit embarrassed and waiting for it all to end. So I'm somewhere between those two extremes, I think.
And there was no difference, really. You were a little bit older between the 1974 Hammersmith and the 2000 Brentwood. How does your stage act carry on these days? Are you still full of that energy you had there as a young man?
I get to look at a lot of that stuff, really, which is on YouTube, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And it's moderately interesting to go back and see how you performed in 1971 at Tanglewood, the orchestral home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, summer venue. And I remember we played for Bill Graham, the concert promoter, back in 1970, I think it was.
Wow.
Or the 1970 Isle of Wight Festival. Those things are part of recorded history, and so You can see your performance, you can kind of analyze it, and it doesn't seem a million miles away, either in terms of the emotion behind it or the physicality behind it. What is a bit excruciating sometimes, the actual musical performance, because it was a bit rough and ready, and maybe suffered from the environmental impact of weather or behavior of audiences or whatever it might be that intrudes upon your ability to deliver the goods.
And of course you started the Thursday Club at the Marquee, sadly no longer there. What were your memories of those days?
Well, it was indeed a Thursday, and it was considered one of the nights of the week that wasn't it wasn't so easy to fill, the Marquee Club. So John G, the manager back in 68, put us on a Thursday night residency as one of the new bands at the Marquee, which he hoped, not unreasonably, would become part of the Friday Saturday night culture, the big nights, and it sort of backfired in the sense that there were a few bands who started in the Thursday night slot but didn't actually then go on to be regular folks at the Marquee, because basically that humble start quickly developed into the opportunity to play at other venues and other clubs and then in other countries.
Did that rise to fame happen too quickly for you, or couldn't it happen quickly enough?
It happened fairly quickly to get to that, from a standing start to being at the end of the first 100-meter dash. But the next stage took 2 or 3 years to achieve. It was just getting off the ground was important, and we did go back to play the Marquee once or twice after we'd become a little bit successful elsewhere in the UK. And we went back to play the Sunbury Jazz and Blues Festival in the summer of 1968, at a point where we and John G, the compere of the festival, were equally surprised by the enthusiastic nature of a big audience, many of whom had seen us play in the few months at their own local little blues club in the back room of some pub in the north of England. And here they all were together at the Sunbury Jazz and Blues Festival, so we got this wave of recognition, which was you know, kind of overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
It just meant that we'd done our work, we'd paid our dues and played up and down the country, and were beginning to reap the benefits in a national kind of sense. So from there, the next year to start playing in the theatres.
And I think part of your success was you were so original. There was nobody like you around, and I think that's how you got such a big audience so quickly.
Well, there certainly wasn't another blues band with a flute in it. That was the big point of difference. And there were lots of blues bands with great guitar players, including Jethro Tull, but not with a point of difference of having an unlikely lead instrument and a performance which was a little more theatricalized than perhaps the sometimes smug and contented purveyors of authentic black American blues who just happened to be born middle-class white boys in the home counties. Suddenly, you know, we didn't quite fit the bill, and we stood out from the crowd, I guess.
Exactly.
In the early years.
Was the flute your first instrument, or were you a guitarist like most 10-year-olds at the time?
I fantasized about playing the guitar as a 9-year-old,
okay.
But was restricted to an Elvis Presley plastic ukulele, and then got a guitar when I was about 12 and didn't really learn to play until I was about 14 or 15, managed to strum a few chords, and by the time I was 17, I think I perhaps even had got by then my very first electric guitar. But at that point, of course, I discovered blues and jazz, so I was not aiming to be a, you know, in the world of pop music or rock and roll as we knew it in the 50s and 60s, but more towards black American music. And then from there, the gentle step into more European influences from folk music and classical music, and even church music, which always was in the background from, you know, my memories of a very limited education in the world of Christian religion as a schoolboy.
And now you are
an English grammar school.
You are a prog rock god. You have awards aplenty. What I was going to say was that this is prog rock. Let's just talk about prog rock, because it was a huge in the 70s. It died a bit, and it's come back. There are plenty of, you know, the Floyd, the Yes, Genesis. Are there Tull tribute bands around? I'm sure there must be.
Well, there were Tull tribute bands around actually a long, long time ago. It's not unusual, I think, that you have in most countries one or two bands that perhaps they don't make a living from it, but mm-hmm. they're keen amateurs and they dress and, you know, perform in the way that they think is it's a bit of play acting, really. I'm not sure it's something I would ever personally find any satisfaction in doing, and I'm always a little embarrassed when I've been around some of those tribute bands when I've appeared at the odd fan convention in two or three countries around the world. But it, you know, they're well-meaning, and sometimes what they lack in musical expertise, they make up for in terms of their bravery in tackling some of the more difficult music, not just
yeah, because it's not easy. Yeah,
you know, they have a good time at it, and what they serve as is an example that you don't just have to sit and listen to music. There's something you like, get up and play it. You know, even if you play it badly, or even if you're just imitating, it's better than just being, you know, an observer who does nothing more than just assimilate music like a piece of blotting paper. So good, you know, good marks all around to those who attempt to be tribute bands, but you know, there's more to life than copying other people. And if you have the ability to copy somebody, then you have the ability to write something of your own, perhaps, and that might be ultimately much more satisfying.
Okay, you seem as busy as ever. You've got a brand new album out, Homo Erraticus. Just give us a little bit of background. I know it's a follow up to the Thick as a Brick 2. I just want to ask you about Thick as a Brick 1 first, because that was not my favourite Tull album. It was my second favourite Tull album. Songs from the Wood was my favourite Tull album, and the stroke of genius of having the newspaper, because, you know, people going through in a record shop looking for albums going, what is this? And that was a great way of introducing a huge audience to the band.
It was an album cover that was, I think, filled our record company with horror and dismay, but they let me go ahead with the idea, so we put together the album cover, which actually took longer to do than record the album.
Really? Okay.
So it was a good 3 weeks of time involved in getting all the artwork together for the album cover and getting everything to the print stage, whereas we recorded the music in about 10 days. So it was a brave idea, and of course we kept quiet about it, and so did John Lennon keep quiet about his album cover, something about somewhere in New York City or something or other, which was released just after Thick as a Brick,
mm-hmm.
Obviously to the horror of his record company, who realized we'd beaten them to it by a few weeks. And it was a single album cover sleeve featuring the front page of the New York Times, but it looked pretty lame compared to the Thick as a Brick, which quickly went on to be number one in the Billboard charts. And so I imagine John Lennon felt somewhat embarrassed and a bit cheated by that. So that's the world we live in. You know, it's the first one past the post, and we got ours out first, and of course he didn't know anything about it, so it was out there, and too late to pull his album, because the manufacturing time for vinyl records particularly is still 3 months. You know, you have to deliver all your, and get everything underway. You can't to pull an album a few weeks before release and start again with a new album cover would be a unmitigated commercial disaster. Unfortunately, I had to live with the consequences of having a great idea, but a little bit too late.
Okay, well, it certainly...
But yeah, it went on to be an important album in the sense of prog rock excess.
Well, absolutely.
And that, in its own way, is a bit of fun, and the fun that I think some prog rock should be. It took itself way too seriously, and the whole nature of Thick as a Brick was to lampoon the concept album prog rock genre in a gentle way, whilst adopting, of course, many of the principles of self-indulgent excess in so doing.
It's also an album that attracted massive acclaim, and so much so that you've brought out, how many years later, I've forgotten, to bring out Thick as a Brick 2, and it's, you know, you've now got out the new album, Homo Erraticus, which continues on that vein.
Yeah, I have said that the new album... Again, slightly jokingly, I've described it as being folk prog metal. And indeed, it draws upon many essential elements of stylings of contemporary rock music, which in their own way sit on quite different shelves of the supermarket. But yes, it is kind of prog. It is a conceptual album, quite over the top in terms of dragging you from 8,000 BC into a period, or sort of BCE, as we're obliged to call it these days, into a period about 40 years into the future from now. So to discuss the, not the history of planet Earth, but particularly of Britain, in its not quite unique position of having been the object of affection for many waves of migration and people from all over the world who ended up being part of our culture and society. It's about migration. It's a hot topic, you know, but I'm doing it in a way that I'm trying to steer clear of politics or rights and wrongs, and really do it in a way that has a kind of whimsical affection for the idea that we do go where the grass is greener, and we are hunter-gatherers, as we always have been. And if we have to stomp on a few heads to get what we want when we get there, we're prepared to do it. And there's Gerald Bostock, my erstwhile co-conspirator.
Absolutely.
Alter ego, says on the album cover, you know, we're all from somewhere else. Get over it.
It's not released till I think April the 14th, is it? But your record company sent me a copy last night. I was listening. I loved it. I noticed on the third track in, you talk about Somerset Levels are in the lyrics. That was
well, there's lots of things that, you know, when you work on something, and perhaps, you know, this was more than a year ago. It was January 1st, 9 a.m. of 2013 when I began the process of writing the album. And so it's a very definitive, this is when I'm going to start. And at the end of a few days, Somerset Levels was locked into place in terms of lyrical content of a piece of music about the early period of migration into the UK, the Romans, the Saxons, the Normans, And I mentioned Somerset Levels. It therefore is perhaps a little embarrassing that people might think, oh, he's trying to capitalize on something that's become a news story for, you know, all the wrong reasons, really, since. But that's happened already two or three other times on this new album. There are two or three other things that I suppose I would choose not to have written that way if I could have forecast the next few months
exactly.
of news stories in the popular press or on the in the world news gathering services. So it's always going to happen. Sometimes you pat yourself on the back a little bit, thinking, "Well, I kind of got there. I didn't prophesy, but at least I wrote something that happened to be a hot topic, even though maybe it wasn't at the time that I wrote the music and the words." But other times it can prove a little embarrassing. Sometimes, I mean, I had to rewrite the beginning of the forthcoming show because I had it set in a hospital with center stage character, head swathed in bandages, in a coma, with doctors, you know, about to
right, pull the okay, plug on him, yeah.
And, our character suddenly comes back to life and miraculously retains at least some of his marbles. But mm-hmm. of course, that was written yeah. a week before Michael Schumacher.
Yes.
So, needless to say, I had to rewrite that to get away from anything that might be, sadly, considered obviously very poor taste if I'd let that, or was now to let that go ahead. So,
Homo Erraticus is definitely an Ian Anderson project. What does that say for fans of Jethro Tull? Is there a Jethro Tull in the future? I mean, I interviewed Martin Barr 3 months ago because he just started a solo tour, etc. He said that sadly he thought those days may be over. He was on a long vacation, but doors were very much unlocked, and he was always welcome to, you know, working with you again. What's your outlook on that?
Well, it's about the same as Martin's, I suppose. I mean, to me, what Jethro Tull means, obviously, there are 28 different members of Jethro mm-hmm. Tull over the years, of which Martin Barr is an important one. But, you know, let's be reasonably clear that over the years it's been, you know, I'm the guy who writes the songs, I was the guy who produced the records.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially managed the band and controlled all the finances and the tour projects and so on and so forth. So, sure, it's a band of musicians, which is ever-changing, and I'm the guy who's still here. But what Jethro Tull means to me, most importantly, it is a collective extended family of musicians responsible for the performances that you hear on record and remember from concert tours. But it's about repertoire. Jethro Tull, to me, means the repertoire, and that repertoire that is simply released under the name Jethro Tull, that's Jethro Tull. Even though it might be, you know, whatever percentage you might accord to me as frontman, composer, and producer, but for me the important thing is repertoire. And if it's stuff that I've released under my own name, it's really probably because it's more concept or project related, or things that are yeah. the orchestral albums, the Christmas things, the string quartet performances, the acoustic tours, the those things I tend to have used my own name out of a sense of welcome release from the purloining of the name more appropriately credited to an 18th century agriculturalist who invented the seed drill. And I am increasingly, I think ashamed is not too strong a word to use, that I've made a living out of stealing somebody else's name. It's just really
There's nothing wrong with that.
I wasn't the guy who thought up the name. I just... having failed O-level history, did not realize our agent had bestowed a name upon us, which was rightfully somebody else's. And to this day, if you Google Jethro Tull, then you know the first two out of three listed hits is going to be Jethro Tull, you know, the musical context.
The band. The farmer, yeah.
Before you get to Jethro Tull, the inventor of the seed drill, and that's kind of sad, really.
Which brings me an interesting question.
Jethro Tull would happily, you know, consider me a thief, which I am.
If possible, and it's not possible, but what would the 60-something-year-old Ian Anderson give advice-wise to a 25-year-old Ian Anderson, if anything at all? Would you have done anything differently?
Well, even at the age of 25, it's too late to ditch the name, so that goes out of the equation. too late to ditch the name by the summer of 1968, really. So we have to rule that one out. But no, I suppose it would be what I do today, and I think it's kind of important, is to try to make sure not only do I learn something new every day, but I try and utilize it tomorrow, and that's, you know, from quite a few years now has been a bit of a motto. You know, every day learn a new trick. The older you get, it's more important to learn a new trick, because old dogs are actually pretty good at learning, and they know how to learn, and they know how to discipline themselves to learn well and to utilize what it is they've learned. So there's a lot of a lot of those old dog adages that you have to rethink in the light of getting old. So yeah, learn something new and use it tomorrow. Don't just sit on it. Share it with somebody.
If that 9-year-old had been not very good at playing the flute or playing the guitar, and you did something completely different, what do you think you could have done?
Well, my other serious career choices, well, it began with being an engine driver like everybody else.
Yeah, of course,
and then
yes.
Moved on to being a soldier or a sailor or an aviator. But it was really in my teenage years that I really locked horns with the idea of career and what would I do. And my big interests were silviculture. I mean, at that point it meant essentially joining the Forestry Commission. If you were interested in trees, then that was about it, the only option, and which sounded a bit dull and probably would have been. But I really like trees. I still do like trees. I plant quite a lot of them. But the other things that caught my attention were journalism and the police force as a career. And I attempted to join the police force as a cadet.
So did I. And failed.
And failed because they were suspicious about my motives. I mean, I was doing fine until they asked me if I had any O-levels. And I admitted to having 8. They snatched away the recruitment form and said, I think you should go back to school and go and get a degree and then come back and we'll give you a really good job in the police force, which was very sensible and good fatherly advice, but not what I was wanting to hear as a 17-year-old who wanted to...
I'll be honest, Ian, I always had you down. If the music ever failed, you have got such a lovely speaking voice. You could have been a radio presenter, or you could have been doing audio, but you could sell sand to the Arabs.
Yeah,
love your voice.
I could sell what Piers Morgan sells to the chumps at CNN who employed him. No, it's one of those things. I do obviously a bit of kind of broadcast stuff, either as an interviewee or occasionally as an interviewer or as a presenter. It really is an exciting thing to do, and I suppose if I had the choice, then I think I would be a serious, maybe not news, but current affairs or whatever, in the world of presentation on television, because I think the bringing of knowledge and information to a very, very broad public and being able to do it in an entertaining way is a very gratifying thing to do. So I greatly admire some of the people that I've worked with and met and in television and radio, and it's I suppose a little bit of me would like to have been like that. A bit too late now. Too late to be a politician.
A little bit. Ian, I must congratulate you on your website. I think it's one of the best music websites I've ever seen. I particularly like if you go into your store and there's you in the old Four Candles coat selling your wares. It's just wonderful. It's a really well thought out and busy website.
Yeah, well, selling Piers Morgan selling whatever it was your analogy was, it's me as Ronnie Barker, really, sort of selling you some stuff you don't really want in the merch stand or digging around the archives in the attic. So it's part of the fun and games of doing these things. And happily, prog rock, for all of its seriousness and self-indulgence, does usually know how to self-lampoon. And if you were on the inside of the Emerson, Lake and Palmer camp, you know, you would have seen that they were quite a fun bunch. Certainly, the idea of self-parody was not lost on them at all. it wasn't really part of their stage act, but, you know, backstage it was, and right and properly so. And I think most of the prog bands, you know, had a sense, pretty good sense of who they were, and sometimes the absurdity of what they were doing. You know, we're all, you know, I said we're all hunter-gatherers. We're all Spinal Tap at the same time.
You're off on a major, major tour starting on 28th of April at Brighton. You're going to not only most of the UK, but you're off to Czechoslovakia, to Slovakia, to Hungary, Germany, and you're talking about going to the US as well, aren't you?
Well, we have, as usual, a couple of bigger US tours scheduled in the latter part of the year. And we usually do the US every year because it's such a huge place. So by the time you've done the US and Canada, it's a bit like painting the Fourth Bridge or the Eiffel Tower. Yeah. It's time to start again. Whereas you wouldn't want to do that in some other countries where, you know, it's more like a 3 or 4 year cycle. I mean, we won't be in Latin America this year, but, you know, probably 2015 we'll be back there again, and we may go to Australia at the end of this year because we haven't been there for.
And it's obviously something you must still enjoy.
It's a cycle, and of course the sad thing is, you know, you get to the point of realizing that it may be the last time that I go to Australia. Mm-hmm. It may be the last time that I go and play Russia or India or wherever it might be, because time is running out, and there's a certain sense of regret when you visit certain parts of the world that you may not go back, and sometimes it's a sense of relief.
But it's almost it's something you must enjoy it, otherwise you wouldn't do it.
Oh, well, I mean, who wouldn't enjoy it? You know, everybody would love to have my job. As I try to point out to people, and you were asking me about advice, is what I always say to young musicians that are learning their instrument is remind them of the fact that 150 days of the year, I am a keen amateur flute player. I'm not getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. I just pick up my flute and go and play for the fun of it. And the fact that there isn't an audience, the fact that I can play lots of wrong notes and not feel too embarrassed is the joy of playing a musical instrument. So the amateur, someone who does it literally for the love of it, it's a good place to be. And we should remember that those of us who are lucky enough to get paid for doing what we enjoy, we don't get paid all the time, whether we choose to do things as, you know, charity shows or whatever, or just do it in the upstairs bedroom when the dogs and cats can mercifully not hear it, then it's doing it for fun, and it is indeed a lot of fun. So of course everybody would love to have my job. Most brain surgeons and 747 pilots would love to have my job, and frankly I wouldn't mind giving a go at what they do for a living either.
And may long you continue to do it, Ian. And thank you so much for talking to us this morning. I wish you the best with the album and the tour. The album's out on the 14th. I've heard it twice now, so I'm getting into it, really liked it. I've loved the band since far too long really. So good luck with the tour. I'm going to try and catch up with it, and again thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm sure you're a very busy man at the moment, taking time to talk to us this morning.
Very good. Nice to talk to you too.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you very much indeed.